Good evening, Mrs. Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is John Kreischer. He is Professor Emeritus of Biology at Wheaton College, where he has taught ecology, ornithology, and vertebrate evolution for 48 years. And we're talking about his latest book, The Peterson Reference Guide to Bird Behavior. John, welcome back to the show. I haven't talked to you in a while.
Thank you, Mark. It's wonderful to be back.
Now, I am always impressed when a really dynamite book comes out that combines beautiful photography and great writing about an important subject. I got to tell you, this book is amazing. Talk to me about putting it together, though. I mean, a lot of people take books for granted. How long did it take you to sort of synthesize all the research that you put in this book into one usable volume? Usable by the general public. And I want to mention that, too. This is not a book for birders only and ornithologists. This is a book for the general public, too.
I appreciate you saying that. And in answer to your question, the actual production time from the time I constructed the outline of the book and went through the approval editorial process and everything was about 4 years. And it was quite literally the first book I've ever gotten in spot on time, on deadline.
I'm amazed as a person who has to face deadlines.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it was an absolute labor of love. And that gets into the other component of your question. And that is, in terms of gathering information for it, I started in 1958 when I became a birder. And I moved through the phases of birding that I think many birders move through.
Yep.
You know, the quest where everything mattered. What mattered was really seeing a new bird, a new bird, a new bird. And I always loved doing it, and I loved the birds. And at one point in my youth, I met a very experienced birder. And he said to my father, your son's pretty good. But he said, what I'm wondering about is in, another 10, 15 years, if the interest he shows today will even be remotely the interest he has then, time will tell. And I passed that test. So there was a lot of accumulated, I won't say wisdom, but accumulated experience that I drew upon when I was structuring how I would design this book.
Plus the fact you've been teaching at the university level for so long, that has to have helped.
I loved taking neophyte students out into the field. These were undergraduates, but it was an upper-level course, so they were mostly biology majors, and I knew them from previous courses. I loved seeing the enthusiasm that they had for birds. And when I left Wheaton College, when I retired after 48 years of teaching, I really tried to impress upon the biology department that my replacement should be focused in ornithology, not just in vertebrate biology or general ecology. And fortunately, that view was persuasive enough that we have a fine ornithologist who has replaced me. But I really loved seeing the students light up when they saw especially bird behavior examples.
This is the point, and I love all vertebrates. I mean, I grew up, my passion originally was herps, and I still get a charge up my spine when I see a snake. But the thing is, as you mentioned, beyond the identification level, once you start to get interested in behavior, you really can't see much other vertebrate behavior other than in birds, because a lot of it happens at night in case of mammals, or it happens in hidden or underneath the water in case of fish. But bird behavior is literally thrown in your face, I would say. You see bird behavior every day.
And in New England, you see bird behavior in the dead of winter. Try that one out on a snake or an amphibian.
Yeah, I know. Don't rub it in. Trust me, I'm going through withdrawal symptoms right now. I'm cherishing every peeper I hear and every frog I see.
Peepers are still at it.
Yeah, they're still at it. Well, you know, they do the weird little single call, you know, that they do at the base of the tree. And they're still in Central Mass. There's eastern painted turtles out for a bask in this warm spell. But bird behavior, I mean, in all honesty, all you need to do, even if you're in the middle of a city, is walk outside or look through the windows of your office, and you're going to see bird behavior. And the important thing to know, and the reason for this book, is what are they doing?
Yeah, believe me, I know what you mean. In the book, I cited an example. I was going to an ornithological conference in Washington, D.C., the North American Ornithological Conference in, I guess it was 2016, and stuck in a cab waiting at a very, very long traffic signal. And there was a juvenile starling up on a pole, and I just spent the entire time watching it. And I kept watching how it kept looking to the right, to the left, tilting its head to look up to the right. I thought, yeah, it's all by itself. There are no other starlings around, and it knows enough to look up and not down because it can be in harm's way if it's not careful at that point. I just found it fascinating, and it made the time pass quite well. You can look at pigeons. They're wonderful birds. My students loved looking at pigeons.
I've seen really wild behavior in the middle of downtown Worcester. I was once watching a house finch, I didn't see that often in among the buildings, singing away, and a blue jay came and ate it. And it was like, you gotta be kidding me. I see migrating hawks over the city all the time. Yep. Mockingbirds love little sort of bushes and do their whole displays. There is so much behavior to see, but again, you can see it, but it's really fascinating when you get to know what it means. Talk to me about organizing this book. I mean, you've taken a huge subject, bird behavior. Mm-hmm. What was it like to trim down everything? First of all, I want to mention, this is not dry. This is a very conversational book, so it's fun to read.
That's my intention.
Yeah, but I mean, you still have to have whittled it down.
Yeah, I imagined when I wrote it that I was standing with a group of people in the field and we had seen something interesting and I'd gotten a few questions about it and I would try then to explain it. So that was part of the underlying structure of how I designed the writing. But in terms of putting it all together, it's the ornithologist in me that came out. There were a number of good bird behavior books, needless to say, out before me, and there are a number out now in addition to mine, and that's wonderful. You can't have too many. What I was thinking about when I was designing it was just how would someone in the field go beyond just saying that's a such and such, because we have a tradition of birding in North America that follows from the to a certain extent from the British model of field marks, and that has graduated into jizz and birding by impression. And the end point in that, it seems to me, for a lot of birders is to just come to a conclusion about what bird they're seeing. But you know as well as I do that here in Massachusetts, the birding crowd is many of them are quite sophisticated and often on mass bird make pretty good comments about the behavior they noticed the bird and all that sort of thing. So I thought there was interest, and I wanted to try to get birders to pull themselves away from just ticking birds and spending some time watching individual birds and being happy when they go into the field looking for a rare bird and not finding it, being happy with the birds that they found.
That is. So you know what pushed a lot of birders over the edge? It was the Atlas II, Breeding Bird Atlas II. I think that really pushed birders to be into behavior watchers for the rest of their lives. And
I would greatly agree with that.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned in the very beginning of your book that field guides today don't talk an awful lot about bird behavior. They're so concentrated on field identification.
That's right.
And you mentioned a book, and I just wanted to give it a shout out. Joseph Hickey. Introduction to the Guide to Birdwatching, and that had so much information about bird behavior in it.
Well, that was one of the things that obviously affected me. I chose to mention it in my book as an inspirational experience to read it and realize. I read it at a good time because I actually was going into my PhD research, and it was very useful to me to see how Hickey had structured, even for average birders, a methodology which was fun to go in and study birds in the field. And, of course, reading David Lack's Life of the Robin and Margaret Morris Nice's work on song sparrows and like a tin version on gulls, it impresses you that common birds tell us a lot. So that's how I began my focus on bird watching. But even then, there was always the temptation, especially when doing trips to various places, to basically be in it for the ID because, you know, you can't spend a lot of time.
Got to rack up the big list.
That's good. No doubt.
Now, you were talking about contemporary books on bird behavior. One of the things that there's been several great volumes on bird intelligence. And as you write in the beginning of your book, I don't think people realize this, the birds have impressive, complex brains. That's in your own words. And talk about that for a minute. I mean, I think most people don't realize that, they're making decisions all the time. They're making choices.
More than we do in the course of the day. If you count up the number of human decisions in the course of the day in a civilization such as ours, it's probably fewer than a chickadee is forced to make in the course of the day, because chickadees are so much more active and they live in a more complex environment. Try to fly through a three-dimensional forest, for instance, at breakneck speed and see how well you do. And then even just selecting which branch to land on among the many thousands of potential landing branches. So to make a long story a little shorter, when I studied ornithology, the concept largely taken from Lorenz and Tinbergen, and to a certain extent from Lack's work, was that birds are essentially instinctive creatures that are born rather with all their software in place.
That's right. And
all they have to do is go out there and there is a kind of stimulus, and then they have a built-in response for that stimulus. And that overlooked, of course, to a certain degree, the incredible learning experiences that birds have. They can learn very quickly. And I give lots of examples of that
in the book.
So what it is that the bird brain is organized differently from the human brain, but not as differently as you might think. It doesn't have large convolutions on the cerebral cortex, the fore part of the brain, but they do have immense optic lobes, and the various layers of brain tissue are profoundly integrated with neurons, more densely organized than in our own brain, and capable of reproduction because birds can grow new neurons in their song areas as well as other areas in the brain, or so it seems. And so when you think about it, compare a bird brain with something like a cell phone, and, you know, people are wondrous about cell phones. How can you get all that into that thing that you carry around? You can get in music and videos and all the stuff that it stores. Think of a chickadee. think of a robin. Those little pea brains are every bit as complex and capable. And imagine what a bird sees and how it has to process it. We look pretty much straight out, and we see in three dimensions. And when we go to our ophthalmologist, they want to know how our visual field is doing to find out if it's narrowing. That's not good. Birds have an immense visual field compared to us, and that means they have that much more information to process. And beyond that, they see in the ultraviolet as well as the other visual wavelengths that we share. And so they quite literally see a more complex world than we see.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight's always a pleasure talking to him, is John Kreischer. He's a professor emeritus of biology at Wheaton College, where he has taught ecology, ornithology, and vertebrate evolution for 48 years. And we're just talking about his latest book. You're talking about something that you want to get that person who loves the natural world for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever. This is the book, Peterson Reference Guide to Bird Behavior. It's a beautiful book. John, I want to talk about, generally, again, sticking in the beginning parts of the book, and we're going to have you come back and talk about more specifics. Some behaviors you write, are universal among bird species. In other words, many, many bird species. Let's give an example of what that would be. The many bird species exhibit that behavior.
Yeah, be glad to. When I was writing this book, I had anticipated a little bit of pushback, which I never got.
That's always pleasant.
From my editor, Lisa White, when I had an introductory chapter on bird anatomy and physiology, and then followed that up with flight, and I thought, well, that seems like a basic ornithology explanation. What about behavior? But you cannot understand birds without understanding what they are.
That's right.
And they're one of the most conservative animals ever evolved, because birds, as all arguably 10,000 plus species of them, some say more, all have certain traits in common, most of which fly, and flight is extraordinarily demanding. And so when you have behaviors such as feather maintenance and preening and dust bathing and whatever, if you want to watch a bird bathe, you can watch it. Occasionally you see shorebirds bathing, you see vultures sunning. You see all sorts of behaviors that are common among many, many different kinds of birds. And they all lay eggs. There's no exceptions. And I talk about why that is likely the case. So they have a conservative physiology and anatomy. And since behavior is all part of maintaining that, then they have lots of behaviors in common. That actually makes the book a bit simpler to write.
But there are also groups of birds, or sometimes species of birds, that have unique behaviors.
Oh, of course.
And I'm thinking specifically acorn woodpeckers. For people, we don't have them here in the East. It's a Western species. But they form this dramatic larder in like a single dead stub that's like really something to see if you've never seen it.
Oh, I've seen it many times, and I write about it in the – I have a chapter in my book on the social behavior of birds, and that's one of the examples that I cite in the chapter. But, yes, there as you go through the various species of birds, you get more and more into unique behaviors that characterize specific species. Perhaps the most unique behavior, although there are several species of them in the world, but of any bird in North America – is the American Dipper.
Dipper.
I know Harlequin ducks can dive in a fed stream and walk along the bottom, so there is a bit of a convergence there. But let's face it, dippers are unique.
Oh, my God. First of all, they even look unique. I don't know another bird that looks like a dipper.
They look like a wren on steroids.
And it's amazing watching them stand on a rock and then they do that sort of bobbing thing like they're getting ready to go, and then bam, into the water, and they're either flying underneath the water or walking on the bottom, picking up invertebrates. It's amazing to watch.
Oh, it is. And then I give other examples. One, for instance, is the black skimmer, which has an utterly unique way of catching prey, as you know, tactily, which is why they can fly at night and still feed. And that makes sense for them because, being a coastal bird, a lot of zooplankton and the fish that eat them come to the surface at night. So skimmers have it made. But skimmers are tactile feeders, but so are many species of shorebirds.
That's right.
And woodpeckers, for that matter, when they probe their tongue into the tree. So there's just all sorts of degrees of difference among birds.
But there's
there are commonalities.
There's even individual birds will exhibit different behaviors from the rest.
Yes.
An example I had about, I forget how many years ago, we had that really horrible winter we had, at least here in the Central Star, we had 150 feet of snow or some ridiculous, 150 inches, or I don't know what it was. A hermit thrush showed up on my feeder in the city and stayed for the entire winter. And I watched it learn to fend off house sparrows. I watched it, and it changed its behavior from any other hermit thrush I had seen so that it could survive.
I can tell you, on that very same winter, I was living in Pocasset, down on Cape Cod, and I had a deck, and I had feeders on the deck, and I had scattered seed on the deck rail, and a hermit thrush did that exact thing, and it finally realized it could take over one of the hanging little tray feeders.
That's right.
And I've got pictures of it. I almost put one in the book. I had one in the book. Actually, that's a funny thing. Hey, you future authors, I was allowed to have in my contract 300 color photos in the book, and I came in with 500, and that was unacceptable.
I'm so, not surprised.
Well, we hit I hope our government will work this way from now on. We hope we hit a good compromise, and we went to pretty near 400. But one of the ones that went, one of the ones I decided to omit was the hermit thrush on the tray feeder. And that same bitter cold winter, what did I have hopping around on my deck, feeding on sunflower seeds, ones that had already been husked? Brown creeper.
Wow.
Brown creeper would come in every day, land at the same place. This was in the bitterest part of the cold. Hop down on the deck and just start spooking around, and I've got pictures of that too. And that's known behavior for brown creepers. It's been observed before. But it birds do develop individual. If it works, they learn it, and then as long as that food source remains, you know, that's the thing everybody worries about bird feeding. Well, what if I go to Florida for 2 weeks in the winter? Are my birds going to starve? Well, if you go to your local, let's say, McDonald's, and it's closed, maybe you'll go to Burger King, or maybe you'll go to KFC. Birds will just leave. They're not going to stay there and starve. They're just going to find more food, find food elsewhere. It is remarkable how quickly they realize, okay, that source is dried up. Got to go.
One of the things you write about, and is this always, I have to always think about this, that birds inhabit a multi-species environment. Birds are always around other species of birds, not just their own kind, but other species of birds, and that determines behavior too.
Oh, yeah. It's the bar scene from the first Star Wars. That's the analogy, the bar scene, because you've got a lot of different-looking things sitting in the same place and with about the same average level of intelligence. And so when you see a lawn with robins and grackles, for instance, and starlings and wow, maybe a song sparrow hopping around, first of all, they're aware of each other. One of the things we bird watchers learn very quickly is that the birds see us and pay attention to us. And there's actually been studies that show that if you stare at them, they'll be much more nervous than if you look away from them. They read your face to a certain degree, especially things like crows. But they're also information centers for one another. If you watch a successful robin foraging and there are other robins around, you're going to find those other robins perhaps will start drawing closer to the one that's feeding. And so they're information centers, and they learn from one another. A bird species is a resource for another bird species, and you can see that in everything from kleptoparasitism to just common behavior at feeders.
It is amazing, but the incredible thing is they know their own species too.
Oh, of course they know their own species, and that's something that is largely innate, but there is learning component to it as well, through imprinting, for instance, which is well studied, especially in waterfowl. But yes, they know their own species, and while it probably would consume too much time to describe it, in my book I talk about some of the most recent research on cowbirds, because why does a cowbird raised by, say, a song sparrow not try to mate with a song sparrow the following year, figuring mom and dad look like little stripy things. Maybe I should find a little stripy thing to, and they don't. So if you want to know why not, we ornithologists have fairly well figured it out, and it's a fascinating story.
Now, birds adapt, including to humans, all the time. And and that I find amazing, that especially city birds, they really learn the way the city works. and the way the buildings work, and use that to their advantage. I'm always amazed by these peregrine falcons that are now nesting in downtown areas, or red-tailed hawks that are also doing the same.
Oh, indeed, yes.
And they can adapt to up to a certain level. I don't want to make it seem like no matter what we do, it's going to be fine with birds. No, but certain species can adapt to an urban environment.
To the point, not only to an urban environment, but to a human environment. We even name them after our environments. We have barn swallows and chimney swifts, so a long history of birds changing their whole behaviors to reflect new resources supplied by these curious bipedal things that wander around, namely us.
Now, we're almost out of time. And we have barely scratched the surface of the first part of this book, which is sort
of... It's been a delightful conversation.
Well, you know, that's the problem. You get together with people like us, it goes off the rails easily. One of the things that's important, though, is that a lot of bird behavior is understandable and knowable if you know what you're looking for or if you know what they do. And that's what your book is about. And as you point out, always ask yourself, what is the bird doing? What is it doing? What is it telling you about itself? And just elaborate for the last minute on that, because every time you're out there, they're doing something. They're never just sitting there.
Well, when you see your fellow humans out and about and behaving in certain ways, there's a thing that psychologists call the theory of mind,
right.
Which is if you see somebody... picking up something, you figure, well, you put them in their place and you put yourself in their place and you think, well, they saw something, they're curious about their picking. Well, birds probably have a theory of mind among themselves too, except that they don't need time to waste. In the course of a bird's day, unlike us, we don't have to fear predation at any particular second in our lives. And most birds, especially the smaller passerines, have to. And so there's little time to waste in a bird's day, and yet they do have downtime. And you can see this in terms of the quietness of bird activity at certain times of day. When you watch a bird doing what it's doing, is it foraging? Is it preparing to courtship behavior? There's so many things you can ask about it. And if it is foraging, watch it foraging, because, you go out and scatter a bunch of cashew nuts around your yard and then wait 48 hours and go out and say, okay, I'm going to have lunch on the cashew nuts, try to find them. Imagine the birds. I have dozens of pictures. One of the things I loved about this book was taking pictures for it.
John, we're going to have to end right there. We're out of time.
Okay, Mark.
So we will have you back. I'm holding you to that. My guest tonight has been John Kreischer. He is Professor Emeritus of Biology at Wheaton College, where he's taught ecology, ornithology, and vertebrate evolution for 48 years. And we're talking about his latest book. It's a beaut. Peterson Reference Guide to Bird Behavior. It's one of those books you can have in your house, and you'll pick it up every once in a while, dip into it, and you're going to learn something new every time you open it up. John, it's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for your kind words, Mark. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.